All right. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all. I'm going to keep saying it every Sunday that I'm up here. I'm Thais Carter. I'm a member of the Adult Ed Committee. Love the new faces. Love the people who are here with us most Sundays. We had such a wonderful LinkedIn Learning series. It is great to see so many of you back for today's presentation. We are so excited to welcome Michelle Minter, who is a friend of this community, who is a member at Witherspoon Presbyterian Church just up the way, but who I think many of us know from over the years. So before we hand things over to Michelle, would you join me in a word of prayer? Creator God, we are so grateful for the opportunity to gather together. That, Lord, as we have been able to sit in the stories of the Old Testament over the last several weeks, that, God, today you bring us into a more recent history. And, God, we want to be as open to what you have to tell us, to show us, and how to lead us based on the history that we hear today. We thank you for the work that Michelle has put into uncovering this history and for the intention and time in sharing it with us today. We pray, God, that you would give us open hearts and open ears. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
First of all, I want to thank Thais. Thank you, Thais. Thank you, Len and Dave Davis, for letting me commandeer the morning. And I also want to acknowledge my friend, my dear friend, Jane Maggard, in the back. I was telling Jane about this research a few months back, and she said, that should be a Nassau Christian Education program. So I'm going to try to prove you right, Jane. Okay, let's get started. Oh, I should tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to talk for a bit and show some images, and then we are going to talk. So as I'm telling this story, pay attention to what resonates, what bothers you, what makes you curious. So that's what we'll talk about. There's an old hymn called Once to Every Man and Nation. Do any of you know it? Okay, lots. It's no longer in the Presbyterian hymnal. It has a difficult tune and difficult poetic words. It goes like this. Once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the fight of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side. One great cause, some great decision, offering each the bloom or blight, and that choice goes on forever twixt that darkness and that light. It is. Once to every person and nation comes a moment to decide. In the last verse, the image is of evil on the throne and truth on the scaffold. But it says that scaffold sways the future. It's a hymn about martyrdom. I first heard this hymn when I was in elementary school, fourth or fifth grade, and we sang it at my church. And my mother, after the service, said to me that she had first sung Once to Every Man and Nation at the memorial service for a minister who was killed during a civil rights demonstration in Cleveland. So this is that story with a few detours. I'm going to tell it in three parts. Part one. In inner city Cleveland, there is a neighborhood called Glenville. And until about 1950, Glenville was an all-white neighborhood. Cleveland was ferociously residentially segregated, not legally segregated, but segregated in practice. There were certain streets that you just did not cross. And after the first black family made its way into Glenville, the neighborhood flipped over very fast to being all black within a decade. And in 1958, the pastor and the session of Glenville United Presbyterian Church were at war with each other. The Presbytery of Cleveland tried to get involved and see if they could mediate this. The problem was that the white pastor was trying to invite black worshipers from the community into worship, and the congregation would not allow that. And the session, the all-white session, was turning black residents away at the door. After multiple attempts to broker this, the Presbytery of Cleveland gave up and shuttered the church. So the pastor went off to take another job. The congregants were told to find other places to worship, which presumably they did in other all-white congregations. And for about 2 years, the church sat empty. And then the presbytery hired a new pastor, Dave Zuverink. He had a church building, but no congregation. So Reverend Zuverink started roaming the neighborhood, knocking on doors, buttonholing people on the street, asking them what they wanted from a church. As you can imagine, he and his wife, Mary Ellen, were subject of quite a lot of curiosity. No one white had moved into Glenville in over a decade. And the people he encountered said to him, "Why should we, in an all-black community, be part of a church led by a white pastor?" And he said, "In the Presbyterian church, the pastor is not really in charge. The congregation is in charge. You can decide what kind of church you want to be." So why did the Presbytery of Cleveland hire a white pastor for an all-black neighborhood? Right, there were no black pastors to hire. One of the very few in that era would have been down the street at Witherspoon Church. I've tried to find the data on what percentage of Presbyterians were white in 1960, and I can't find it, but I can tell you what percentage of Presbyterians are white right now. Any guesses? It's 89%. So in 65 years, we have made it to 89% white. So Dave Zuverink got this church up and running. Amazingly, it really did work. I think there was a deep hunger for an interracial fellowship. And within 2 years, he had 150 people routinely in worship. He had found a black associate pastor from another denomination. My parents were among those very early families. My parents are interracially married, and I was one of, by Reverend Zuverink's count, 43 mixed-race children that he baptized during those years that he was at that church. So here's the church in its very early days. So now let's forward to April 1964. Let me remind you what is going on in the Civil Rights Movement. August 1963 is the March on Washington. Dr. King gives his I Have a Dream speech. In September, four black girls are killed by a bomb at their church in Birmingham while they're waiting for Sunday school to start. In November, President Kennedy is killed, and President Johnson vows to pass a civil rights bill, which does pass late in 1964. In Cleveland, the key issue was the desegregation of the schools. As remember, I said that the city was very residentially segregated, and the all-white school board was ruthless in redrawing the lines of school districts so that black and white children would never go to school together, even though sometimes they were just blocks apart from each other. So as the city became majority black, the black schools were very, very overcrowded, and the white schools, literally blocks away, were sitting half empty. And the key activist organization working on this was CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. This is not one of the best known of the civil rights organizations, but it was quite important. It was an urban, more progressive, radical civil rights organization. It tended to use interracial coalitions more than many of the more southern-based civil rights organizations. Its most famous activity was the Freedom Rides, when they took a very small group of an interracial group of travelers to test the interstate bus system, and they encountered very, very significant violence, but did in fact lead to the desegregation of the bus system. So they had been leading protests for months, black parents working to try and get the schools to desegregate, which the school board was absolutely not going to do. And then the school board announced that it was going to build new schools in Glenville, all black schools, in order to relieve overcrowding. The schools just blocks away were half empty, but it would not desegregate. So we come to Monday, April 6th, 1964. Here's Reverend Zuverink telling the story. About 20 of us gathered in the church basement that morning, preparing ourselves for acts of civil disobedience against the building of a new segregated school near the congregation which I served in the Black community. A few of us had met before. I recognized leaders from CORE and the NAACP and a few Black and white pastors and priests and rabbis. Mostly these were parents of Black children who had been forced to go to school for only half a day for many years because the school board refused to allow them to attend half-full, mostly white schools in nearby neighborhoods. They were both angry and committed to fight for their children. As we started in our training, we were introduced to an amazing charismatic guy called Byard. Byard told us about the young people who had last year successfully used the weapon of peaceful civil disobedience to begin to change massive segregation in the South. Byard was most convincing and inspiring. We broke into two groups, one who would simply sit back to back in a small circle and show that we would not be moved no matter what. The others acted as perpetrators of verbal abuse. They threatened violence. They used rolled up newspapers to hit us and spewed vile language on the defenseless group. We then exchanged places. Several in our group asked to be excused from the training. They said they knew that they could not take this abuse without physically fighting back. Byard was just awesome in his response. He praised the dropouts for being so honest and for really knowing themselves. There was to be no shame. By morning's end, we had been very well prepared for the sit-in planned for the next day. I wondered, who is this Byard guy anyway, and where had he learned all this stuff? Anyone? Byard Rustin. Yes. Byard Rustin is much more famous now than he was then. If you haven't seen it, there's an excellent movie that came out last year about him. You can still see it on Netflix. So Byard Rustin was a Quaker, lifelong pacifist. He served prison time as a conscientious objector during the Second World War. He was one of the founders of CORE. And he was the person who trained Martin Luther King Jr. and the other major civil rights figures in the tactic of civil disobedience. So Dr. King learned about the theology of nonviolence from Gandhi and others, but he learned the tactics from Byard Rustin, who had been using them since the 1940s. He was also the architect and the organizer of the March on Washington, which had taken place the previous summer. So why was he not better known? Well, because he was openly gay. And at that time, that meant he was, or there was risk of scandal, which could taint the movement. So he was always present, very much involved in all kinds of discussions and conversations and deliberations, but always stayed largely behind the scenes. So now he has become better known than he was at the time. At the time, he was really not known at all, even though he was very part of everything. What I want you to notice is his focus on the preparation and cost of civil disobedience. It is not for everyone. It is something that requires work and discipline and commitment, and it is fine, as he says, that it is not for everyone. It's really a specialized tactic that only works in some circumstances. So we come to Tuesday morning, April 7th. That morning, a larger group gathered for breakfast at another church to prepare to go to the protest site, which was the construction site for the new school in Glenville. And Reverend Zuverink sat next to one of his closest friends, another young white Presbyterian pastor named Bruce Klunder. Part two. So Bruce Klunder was 26. He had only been ordained a couple of years earlier. He was the Presbyterian chaplain of Case Western Reserve University, which is the large university downtown in Cleveland. And he was based at Church of the Covenant, which was a very large, elite Presbyterian church, literally embedded in the campus. So it had exactly the same relationship to Case Western Reserve as Nassau has to Princeton University. Okay. He was also one of the founders of the Cleveland chapter of CORE. He and his wife, Joanne, had taken a group of students a couple of years earlier south to learn about the civil rights movement, and had ended up having dinner with very young and totally unknown John Lewis, who deeply impressed them, and they came back and got very involved in civil rights in Cleveland. Joanne Clunder says, Bruce was not a white liberal, and neither am I. We crossed over the white liberal line long ago after coming to the realization that the interracial coffee clutches, the intergroup discussions about mutual problems, the get-to-know-a-Negro home visitation programs, and the other activities of the people of goodwill were too bland a diet for us to stomach. The recipe for a civil rights movement has to include a generous sprinkling of red-hot militants if it is to be successful. This is Joanne Clunder with their daughter walking the protest line. That year, Bruce gave a sermon in Oregon when he was visiting his hometown that is a really remarkable description of how structural racism works. It's amazingly sophisticated and painfully modern. The language is a little old-fashioned. We don't call black people Negroes anymore routinely, but other than that, it is remarkably modern. And at the end, he says this, we must, each in his own way, suffer. Oh, and remember, he's talking to an all-white congregation when he's giving the sermon. We must, each in his own way, suffer with and for those who are oppressed by those structures of injustice. This will mean that we must learn to feel their pain as our own, and that we must be willing to bear personally some of the cost of that pain's removal. The policy of many of us has been that justice is fine if it doesn't cost us anything, economically, socially, or politically. That time is past. Changes are taking place which will inevitably cost us all something. Are we willing to bear this cost with a realization that it is only a small part of what many have been forced to pay for many years? We must learn to feel the injustices of the structures of our society as do those who are oppressed by them. I've brought copies of Clunder's sermon. If you're interested, please pick up one. It's a really good read. So, it's Tuesday, April 7th. The protest starts at the construction site. Here you can see the site and the protesters working. In the very first wave of activity at the site, Reverend Zuverink and several others blocked a dump truck that was trying to enter the site and were promptly arrested. So Reverend Zuverink was taken downtown. He was parked in a cell waiting for bail to be made. And then nothing happened for a while. They didn't bring anyone else in. And then after a couple of hours, they started to bring in young black men who were very agitated and upset. And Reverend Zuverink didn't recognize any of them. They weren't those who had been prepared as part of the protest demonstration, and yet they'd clearly been at the site of the demonstration. So he leaned over to one of them in the next cell and said, what happened? And the young man said, everything was going fine until that bulldozer ran over the Zuverink guy and all hell broke loose. So Dave Zuverink knew he had not been run over by a bulldozer. So he figured out pretty quickly what must have happened. Joanne Clunder was at the zoo with her two children, and an announcement came over the loudspeaker asking her to come to the office where a police officer told her that Bruce had been killed. Several people had positioned themselves, thrown themselves in front of a bulldozer, and Clunder had gone to the back of the bulldozer and lay down behind it. The bulldozer driver didn't realize he was there and backed up and crushed him instantly. I'm going to show you the picture of the scene. I'll just put it up for a few seconds. If you'd rather not see it, you can see the body in the photo, then this is your warning to look away. And on to the next image. This set off a riot, as would have been the terminology at the time. People attacked the bulldozer driver. It was not clear at the time whether it was intentional or not. there were rocks thrown, bricks, bottles. Mounted police arrived. They use tear gas. The protest chaos riot went on well into the night. It was the worst civil rights violence in Cleveland's history up to that point. And it was one of the very first race riots or race uprisings of the 1960s. So the Watts riot, which is the first of the really famous riots, was in 1965, a year after this. Eventually, there would be a very significant race riot in Cleveland in 1967 that destroyed the neighboring community of Huff and badly damaged Glenville. But this was the first of those uprisings. Clunder's death was national news. It made the front page of the New York Times. And many people weighed in with a point of view about what it meant. One was a white supremacist organization, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, which put out a press release explaining that it was Clunder's fault because he had broken the law. One of the people who weighed in with an opinion was Malcolm X. Part three of our story. So now we have to rewind to the previous Friday night, April 3rd, when CORE, in order to drum up energy for the protests, which were planned for the following week, invited Malcolm X to come speak in Cleveland. Malcolm was at the height of his fame, or really notoriety. He had recently broken with the Nation of Islam. He was starting his own civil rights organization. He was still very much a black nationalist. He pretty much believed white people were Satan. And that night, he spoke at CORE United Methodist Church, which is about 10 blocks from Glenville Presbyterian Church. It's also in Glenville. CORE had once been the largest synagogue in Cleveland. It seats about 2,500 people, so it's about four times the size of the National Sanctuary. And that night, 4,000 people crammed in, mostly black, to hear Malcolm speak. I'm really fascinated to know what the Methodist hierarchy thought of this. I'm just like, it doesn't seem really like their thing. But that night, Malcolm gave what would be his most famous speech, which is called The Ballot or the Bullet. It's about 35 minutes long. He began, as he often did, "Mr. Moderator, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, I just can't believe everyone in here is a friend, and I don't want to leave anyone out." This speech was so famous that it was actually printed and released as an LP. You can find it on YouTube, and I encourage you to check it out. It's really fascinating. I'll give you a couple of excerpts from it. In 1964, it's time now for you and me, remember he's talking to a primarily black audience now, to become more politically mature and realize what the ballot is for, what we're supposed to get when we cast a ballot, and that if we don't cast a ballot, it's going to end up in a situation where we're going to have to cast a bullet. It's either a ballot or a bullet. The political philosophy of black nationalism means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community, nothing more. So, political power, right? Where the government has proven itself either unwilling or unable to defend the lives and the property of Negroes, it's time for Negroes to defend themselves. Article number 2 of the Constitutional Amendments provides you and me the right to own a rifle or a shotgun. If the white man doesn't want the black man buying rifles and shotguns, then let the government do its job. So, self-defense. Malcolm X was not a believer in nonviolence. He and Bayard Rustin actually had a point of agreement here. Rustin said, "Nonviolent civil disobedience is not for everyone." Malcolm absolutely agreed with that. So that's Friday night, April 3rd. Monday, Bayard Rustin is training at Glenville Church. Tuesday, Bruce Clunder is killed. Wednesday, April 8th, Malcolm X gives a press conference. He's still in Cleveland. And he is asked about Bruce Clunder's death. And this is what he says. "I'm not going to stand up and applaud any contribution made by some individual white person when 22 million black people are dying every day. What he did, good, Good, great, hooray, hooray, hooray. Now, Patrice Lumumba was murdered. Medgar Evers was murdered. Emmett Till was murdered. My own father was murdered. It's time that some white people started dying in this thing. What I love about Malcolm X is he is really frank. He's also correct. And I think Bruce Klunder would agree with him. In the course of the civil rights movement, thousands of black people were killed, injured, abused, threatened with violence, lost their jobs, their education, their homes. But one white person was killed, and it made the front page of the New York Times. That is our traditional culture in America. It says that black suffering and sacrifice is business as usual, and white suffering and sacrifice is important. I don't want you to forget that even though Bruce Klunder's is the name that we know best from this incident, there were hundreds of black parents walking those picket lines, positioning themselves as well under construction machinery. They are anonymous to us because they survived. But they are also part of this story. The other thing that I want to make sure that you don't lose sight of is that even though this is a story that involves a number of Presbyterians, Presbyterians were not at the center of the civil rights movement. Presbyterians were far more likely to be blocking the door at Glenville Church. So we have to keep Malcolm's reminder, harsh as it is, in mind. That Friday, Bruce Klunder's memorial service was held at the Church of the Covenant, and the congregation sang "Once to Every Man and Nation." After a pause, the school construction went ahead aggressively. And in fact, the Cleveland Public Schools were not desegregated until 1973 under court order, when a landmark court decision ruled that in fact the schools had been maintaining, or the school officials had been maintaining, a segregated system. And the building of the school in Glenville was one of the key pieces of evidence of this. After a few more protests and demonstrations, the civil disobedience activism trickled or sort of died down, and CORE regrouped. A scholar who works on CORE, her name is Nishani Fraser, says, "The thinking was if they would rather roll over a minister then do something as simple as desegregate, it brought up the fundamental question of whether it was really possible to sway the heart of the oppressor through nonviolent protest. So when Bruce Klunder was killed, the understanding began to permeate the movement that racism was so intertwined with political and social structures that protest just wasn't going to be enough." So CORE pivoted towards focusing on political power. In other words, they moved from Rustin's strategy toward Malcolm's strategy. And in 1967, Carl Stokes was elected the first black mayor of a major American city. One of the groups that was all in on the Stokes campaign was the Congregation of Glenville Presbyterian Church, where Reverend Zuberink invited Mr. Stokes to preach the sermon several times. So now we are at the end of the story. Although, of course, I want you to remember, this is, I've told it in a very simplified form, and of course, it is not actually the end of the story. The story is still ongoing. It's just the pause for today. And as I've thought about this and researched it, I've reached the conclusion that "Once to Every Man and Nation" is incorrect. There is no one great moment to decide. Rather, we make many small, ongoing decisions when we encounter ethical and moral challenges and quandaries. And we make those decisions with the information that we have at the time, which is often quite imperfect. If we are wise and self-aware, we may even change tactics or adjust our philosophy as we go along. CORE changed tactics. Within a year, Bayard Rustin had moved from focusing on civil disobedience to focusing on black political power. He never stopped believing in nonviolent civil disobedience, but he was coming to understand that it wasn't the right tactic for the era which was coming. Within a year, Malcolm X was dead. He was assassinated in February 1965, but he had moved toward an understanding of the potential of interracial coalitions. So Rustin and Malcolm were moving toward each other. I'm going to give the last word to Bruce Klunder, and these are literally the final words of the sermon that I quoted to you earlier, where he says, "To understand suffering and make it your own will not dictate a particular strategy of action, but it will throw you into the battle to make your own decisions. As a follower of him who suffered all, that we might be one. Our Lord is risen. In him we have peace and life. Amen." Thank you all for listening.
If you have questions, I will run the mic.
And I would love to hear what questions this raises for you, or what puzzled you, bothered you, resonated with you in this story.
Just the citation on that sermon, when was that?
It was in August 1963. And I have copies here if you'd like
that's
to
the
have.
One from Oregon,
yes. Yes.
I appreciate your description of Cleveland at that time. I understand that New Jersey has some of the worst segregated schools in the nation. As someone who raised children who grew up in completely integrated situations, as a matter of fact, I did back in Illinois before civil rights movement, I don't understand, and I say that very sincerely, I don't understand this accusation at this time. Do you have any insight?
Into the idea of residential segregation in New Jersey?
Yes.
Not specifically, but segregation is linked to many forces which are hidden. So some of it has to do with the effects of race. It's often very economically based, right? Redlining and various other things for generations helped to kind of create situations in which neighborhoods or communities were known as a black community or a white community. Once the schools are seen as not good or good, then people who can get out of that district will move somewhere else. So you end up often with pockets of poverty or with communities that are sort of de facto still fairly racially segregated. I actually encourage you to read Klunder's sermon, where he talks about how these factors sort of work together to kind of maintain this sort of segregation. I don't believe right now in New Jersey that we probably have what they had in Cleveland at that time, where the school board was very intentionally maintaining segregation. Our systems would now do a better job of addressing things that are that obvious, but they don't always. I see a couple of...
I'll just answer from my perception. In New Jersey, we enforce segregation by zoning and by keeping low-income housing out of the suburbs. This has been going on. I mean, there was a court ruling in 1973 or 4, and hasn't been enforced, and here we are 50 years later. So this is really the methodology that we use in New Jersey, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in other words, systems and structures are very good at maintaining segregation.
First, thanks, Michelle. That was not quite as happy a story as I was, but very honest. So our kids grew up in Montclair, which is a very racially balanced community. And when the school board said we have to integrate, what they did is they took the faculty from the neighborhood schools on one end and put them on the other end, and they put enriching programs. So everyone chose a school not by neighborhood, but by program, and it was rocky, but it worked. Mm-hmm.
What I'm about to say is something I am not proud of. I grew up in Chicago on the north side, and let me tell you, Chicago was segregated. Mm-hmm. And when I bought my first house in Evanston, Illinois, I lived in it for only 6 months before I was transferred to New York. And when I went to sell it, the neighbor across the street came and said, "Oh, you're such a nice young couple. I'm so sorry to see you go. You're not going to sell the blacks, are you?" And I said, "No, I will not." And I'm very sorry today that I said that and enforced it. Mm-hmm. And I was so deeply relieved to move into a New Jersey community where I had a black family living five doors away, and my children played with their children, and the grandfather who lived with them was absolutely the most godly man in the Presbyterian church in that town. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for saying that. I think this is just the reality. Peer pressure is incredibly strong. Social pressure is incredibly strong. If you wanted to sell your house and you wanted your house to maintain value in a society that was segregated and racist, that's often how people made decisions. There were a lot of incentives to make those decisions.
So thank you for that wonderful description of the story from a number of years ago. It's so tempting for us, I think, all to think about these issues as being a long time ago, far away from us. But as some of the comments have illustrated, New Jersey, in fact, is not only highly segregated, it's one of the few states in the country that's becoming more segregated over time than it was even in the last 10 or 20 years ago. And there's a lawsuit that's currently pending attempting to find a way to resolve that issue with schools, because it's particularly difficult with school districts because they tend to reinforce those boundaries, those divisions. Mm-hmm. But the issue is current, it's pressing. Just three, four days ago, there was a finding by the U.S. Justice Department that the Trenton police routinely violate the civil rights of residents with abuse and pepper spray and violence. So I wonder if you could comment about how we think about the lessons of the story you've just shared for us today.
Yeah, thank you, John. I have found that this story really resonates for me in this current moment. We are in another era that is much like the 60s into the early 70s. Again, we have very complicated cross currents, with different understandings and arguments about what would constitute equality. Backlashes or corrections, it depends on your political point of view, I suppose. Activists pushing very far on the progressive side, pushing way back on the conservative side. Even among progressive activists, significant disagreements about tactics and priorities. This is another messy era. And I want to stress, in 1964, it was messy, and people didn't have the hindsight of 65 years. I can look ahead and say, well, Carl Stokes was going to be elected mayor, and then there's going to be all of that was in the future in 1964. We are in a moment like that, where we don't know what people will look back on and see in this moment, and where we are working with the imperfect information. So we just have to make decisions. I do think many of the same social structures are still very present. The New York Times today has the article about the Trenton police. So check that out if you haven't had a chance. I also think we're seeing an enormous amount of activism right now that does not understand the principles of civil disobedience. We see a lot of kind of what I would call well-intended but cost-free activism. A lot of posting on Facebook and Instagram. I work for Princeton University, where we have seen at least some students who seem to think there should be no consequences for breaking rules or breaking the law. The whole principle of civil disobedience is there will be consequences. You do it because you want the consequences to become visible to others. It's not we're going to get away with not having consequences. So you expect there will be consequences. But I think we've gotten out of that mode of activism. We use the internet to kind of substitute very often for ways to express ourselves. So yes, I think that time and this time have a lot in common. I think we can learn a lot from just sitting with the complexity and the messiness of that era.
I want to thank you for your presentation, as well as to a lot of the people in adult education who have a lot to offer from just historical knowledge. We brought a lot of middle schoolers in, sort of halfway through the middle. And I think that shifted the demographic of this audience in a lot of ways. We're about to be, we're about to be ordained as ministers or work in ministry in some ways. And we're looking at difficult situations where, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, one of the biggest hurdles is this idea of the white moderate. And going too far in one direction or not. Students or current middle schoolers and high schoolers, what sort of advice, encouragement, listening do you have for the current state where we're at?
Yeah. I think we're in a, as I said, a really complicated time. One thing that I would stress to you is that if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, many of the most important activities, the most key moments, were undertaken by college students and even high school students in the South. College students were an incredibly, incredibly important part of this. These were young people who were passionate and who were willing to take risks or push beyond what the sensible grown-ups thought was feasible. And as a result of their activism, in large part, it was discovered just how much farther there was that you could go. They were the ones, you know, who at the lunch counter sit-ins and so on, really started to demonstrate how nonviolent civil disobedience could be used. Okay, so young people have a lot of power here. Your passion and your commitment can be really, really effective. What I would encourage you to do, though, is understand, learn some of this history, because as I said, these tactics are not, as Bayard Rustin has said, these tactics are not for everyone. They take actual work, training. You have to be really clear about your goals. Things can get out of control very quickly, as they did in this case when all of a sudden things don't go the way you expected and chaos can break out. Learning your history, understanding yourself to be a very powerful force for change is important. You are actually, your passion can really matter in all of this, but you have to use it well, and you have to understand that it's costly to be activists. It sounds, it can be kind of seem sort of fun and exciting, and you post things on Instagram or whatever. I don't know what young people use now. They probably don't, you probably think Instagram is really old school. But real activism will still be costly.
So as a high schooler, I really do see the segregation in our schools, and I think it's almost more of like a, like I see it in the government of the school system as well, but socially, like you see these groups segregate people, and as someone looking in, I hear what you're saying about like you have to make sacrifices because socially you get outcasted for inviting these people in who are the same as you, and it's looking back at the history of this like terrible time and that we're still in, it's so hurt, like it's so sad to me that like we're still so stuck in time. And although people think that we're progressing forward, it's prevalent that if you're immersed into the culture of a high school society, the segregation is so relevant. And like in our school, and I go to Hopewell, so it's not as diverse as Princeton, there just aren't people with different skin colors who are like the popular kids or are like invited into like bigger groups of kids that aren't as outcasted. Mm-hmm. And even the teachers, like they don't of course like outwardly say it, but like the problem with like vaping and drug use in our school, like children with like a lighter complexion will be like taken more seriously and will be looked after like more intensely than one without. And I see this problem and it hurts my heart because there's nothing I can do as a student because I've brought the problem up against some of my teachers and they just dismiss it. Because although some teachers are good of heart, some teachers aren't, and there's nothing we've tried. There aren't enough teachers to replace in the public school systems to replace the bad ones, essentially. So it's so prevalent in our school systems and it's hard that we can't change it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for saying that out loud, right? I think it actually helps to just own that. You probably can't change your school system, but a lot of what we do is not at the structural level, it's at the personal level. Both of those two things are happening all the time. It's both who you are in relationship with in your life, as well as the systems and structures. So if you can hold both of those things in your mind, keep doing what you're doing. That awareness is the first step toward the day when you are a voter, when you can make career decisions and life decisions that will allow you to act on your values. Right now, it may be mostly about who your friends are, but it'll always be about who your friends are, as well as the structural issues.
So sorry, we have to wrap. Can we have another round of applause for Michelle?
Thank you all.
I hope that many of you will come back to join us next week. We are kicking off Advent, Hope in a Weary World. And I have to say, next week's speaker, Dr. Heath Carter, he's pretty great. But he's going to be talking about the sense of our small effort, faithful witness in dangerous times. So I hope you'll come back and join us.